You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Rube McLaren tōku ingoa, no mai hare mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Monday the 30th of April. I'm joined in studio by Mary Margaret Slack and Lucy Austin. How was your weekend?
Yeah, it's good.
Tiring. I went to an Indian wedding.
Oh, fun.
How was that?
Long.
Yeah. What did you dress up as?
They didn't give me a sari, so I came in like high heels and a dress and stuff.
Yeah, how would you feel wearing a sari?
It was the bride. I know the bride's brother, and he like told me to wear that because I would. I did what he told me to do.
Yeah. It'd be an interesting one, wouldn't it?
It was, the dancing was beautiful. Yeah.
I heard they're just grand. Absolutely huge.
They're huge. They have like a massive fire on stage because in their like, you know how like European weddings will have a celebrant because it's like the legal side. They'll have a fire because it's like a fire is seen as like a deity, a god, and it like has to witness stuff for it to be official.
Oh, cool.
And it was immense. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Sounds awesome.
So today we've got a packed show. Lucy speaks with David from the Auckland City Mission about the current food deficit and the record number of food parcels being given out. I catch up with Green Party co-leader James Shaw. We discuss the draft Productivity Commission report and electric vehicles, as well as the Greens contesting the Northcote by-election. We also have Southern Cross, where we'll learn about Pacific research and strategy, media freedom and Facebook censorship. Mary Margaret asks Rod Oram about the AMP financial scandal in Australia and if there are implications for New Zealand. I also speak to Shyla Groot, an Auckland University academic, about why homelessness is so bad in New Zealand. And lastly, Mary Margaret speaks to the Tertiary Education Union President Sandra Gray about academic freedom in New Zealand. Remember, if you have any thoughts to share, send us a text on 5395 or give us a call on 309 3879.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Auckland City Mission are currently overwhelmed with requests for food parcels. For this month alone, they have given out over 1,150 food parcels, with the number increasing rapidly. I spoke to David Chalionis from the Mission to find out a bit more about the issue and what needs to be done to help. Before I play this interview, if you would like to donate food to the Mission, you can drop it off on Hobson Street or at the New World Supermarket at Victoria Park and Devonport.
So it was recently announced that there's been a 25% increase in demand for food. You know, we've had a lot of talk around a housing crisis, but if people can't afford food, how are they going to afford housing? Why do you think this problem has got to this point?
That's a really good point you bring up regarding if they can't afford food, how are they going to afford housing? Certainly with food insecurity, we have seen unprecedented demand on our services. And it's not just us, it's all agencies working in the sphere are all kind of saying the same thing. For us, we have given away over 1,150 food parcels this month, which is the most we've ever done. This year, we're on target to give away 15,000 food parcels for the year. And these are all, you know, records that we're breaking that we really, really don't want to be breaking. You know, they're really sad, sad records to break. I mean, to put those numbers into context, we, you know, 5-10 years ago, we were giving away 7,000 food parcels, 8,000 food parcels a year. So, you know, we really have seen a slow creep, and now we're beginning to see it spike. It is really sad to see.
And what sort of people are coming and requesting these food parcels? Is it families? Is it individuals? Is it young people?
The majority of people who access our emergency food service are women, and they are mums, they are grandmas, in a lot of situations, and they're feeding their families. So that is the majority of people that we see are mums with kids. So that's obviously very hard to see, but it's something that we, as well as seeing the hardship, we really do see a lot of resilience from these women who, you know, often if they're, you know, being told for other people they need to, you know, go and get, you know, budgeting advice, or they need to go and know their budget to an absolute degree. They know where every single cent is being spent, and yet they are incredibly resilient and hardworking people. A lot of times we see people who come and access the service are working. In a lot of cases, they have jobs. In a lot of cases, two people in the families have jobs. So it is really, you know, that is the level of food insecurity that we can currently see in New Zealand. It is, yeah, that is what we are seeing now, people working, accessing food service.
What do you think's gone wrong, and what do you think's failed to cause this spike and these numbers to just rocket up?
Well, I think when people are struggling, the first thing that happens is they need to pay their bills. So they need to pay their power, they need to pay their rent, and these are the things that go out first. So food essentially becomes discretionary, and what little money is left over will go on food, and sometimes there is nothing left over. So that's where we see people coming into a food bank, coming to us, because they don't have anything left over. And again, I think in terms of what's driving the increase, the cost of living has been going up and up and up. Everyone feels that, whether you're in desperate need or not. And, you know, rents are going up, cost of living's going up, food's going up. Something does have to give. And that's, you know, we're kind of seeing that kind of dam bursting now. And, you know, the spike in our services is, you know, a reflection of that.
There's obviously been a recent increase in the minimum wage. Do you think we'll see the effect of that come in? Is it too soon to notice? Do you think it's made any difference?
Oh, I think it will definitely make a difference. I think, you know, people getting more money, they're going to have more money to spend on food to feed their families.
I mean, this is obviously people in New Zealand, a first world country, that are struggling to feed their people. What do you think the government needs to do to address this issue?
Well, firstly, I think no one group is going to be able to solve this problem by themselves. So it's not so much a matter of what can the government do, or, you know, what can NGOs do. It's what we can all do together. Mm-hmm. So government working together with NGOs, working together with local government, working together with community groups, working together with school groups, working together with the business community. It's all of our responsibility to kind of sort this out. And I think some feedback that we get a lot from Aucklanders currently is that they are really quite uncomfortable with the levels of inequality that we're seeing in our society, in Auckland in particular at the moment. And I think that's really healthy, that we are uncomfortable with what's happening and that it doesn't become the status quo. And I think we are seeing a good response across the board from, as I mentioned, you know, government, local government, NGOs, community groups, business community as well, all really coming together to try and work on this problem together. So yeah, I think it's not just one group who's going to get to the bottom of this. It's all of us that need to do it.
And if there's somebody out there right now listening who's struggling and can't afford food, what's the process that they need to go through in order to get a food parcel from the mission?
They can call us at any time. Just Google our website. We're on a Facebook, can be a very good way for people. You can just go onto our Facebook and comment. That can be quite a cheap way for people if they don't have money on their phone, or they can't get in, you know, to pay bus for a train fare to come in and see us. But certainly, you know, anyone can come in at Hobson Street, 140 Hobson Street, at any time. So, you know, please do reach out if you are struggling. Please, you know, don't suffer in silence. We do have, you know, trained social workers here who can, you know, sit down, we'll have a chat. Often we can advocate on our client's behalf to whatever social service they may be dealing with. You know, we do have trained people on site who can really help people with what's going on in their lives, and we can work out what we can do, potentially some structural things that may be going on, debt consolidation, things like that. We can, you know, we really can advise and try and help people along that, as well as, you know, providing the, you know, more emergency need of food, which we can give them as well.
Excellent. You're calling for people to drop off food. Where can people do this? What food do you need?
For sure. Definitely. Currently, we are really, really short on cans. So, yeah, we've given in the last 3 months over 3,000 food parcels, which is, you know, over 50,000 cans in 3 months. So we are short on cans. Any canned food, beans, anything hearty, lentils, you know, chickpeas, anything, you know, that people can, you know, cook up and make a decent meal out of. We get fresh fruit and veg, we get meat, we get all sorts of things being donated. So, you know, if you don't have cans and you've got some other stuff, please do let us know. And definitely we do just are encouraging everybody who, you know, wants to help us just to get engaged with the work that we do, help us out in our appeals, become, you know, an advocate for us in their own lives, you know, as well as helping us out at this particular time of stress for food that we need.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
That was David Chirlionis from the Auckland City Mission. And if you would like to donate food to the mission, you can drop it off at Hobson Street or at the New World Supermarkets at Victoria Park and Devonport.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Yes, indeed. We've got James Shaw on the line. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
Oh, very good. Weather's not too good up here, though. How's it in Wellington?
Miserable. Yep. Turns out winter's a bit like that.
So, first up, the Northcote by-election. This was triggered by Nationals' Jonathan Coleman vacating the seat, and Labour's Shannon Halbert and Nationals' Dan Bedouin are both vying for it. Now, the Greens have put their hat in the ring. Co-leader Manama Davidson has said that the local branch saw the by-election as an opportunity to promote their early successes in government, adding that they want to advocate for greater progressive change on issues like health, housing, water and transport. All noble causes, but practically speaking, might this just take away votes from the Greens' partner Labour, thereby helping National into a better position?
Well, I mean, our preference is always to stand in by-elections. There have been a couple where we haven't stood for, you know, various reasons, but we've always said that basically the democratic choice comes first. And, you know, there are issues that, you know, we stand for and we want to campaign on. Our likely candidate there is Dr. Rebecca Zhang, a Korean medical doctor. Of course, the seat's been vacated by the former National Health Minister, so it's a good opportunity for us to highlight the differences between us and the opposition on health. You know, housing, obviously, big Auckland issue, and, you know, public transport across to the North Shore. North Shore Rail is something that we've campaigned on very strongly. So there's some things that we really have stood for that we don't want to be silent on. We want to continue to advocate for. If we hadn't stood, then you'd be getting accusations of, you know, dirty deals and all of that kind of stuff as well. So, you know, we're going to get criticism whether we stand or whether we don't. I think on this one we just decided that on balance it made more sense to stand than not.
What if the votes that go to Green are the votes Labour maybe would have needed to get over the line? What happens then?
That does happen. I would argue that that's a flaw in our voting system. I mean, personally, it's not a party position, but personally, I think if we had ranked ballots for candidates, then you would see, a kind of more sincere voting pattern. But ultimately, voters are pretty smart, they know how to cast their vote for the most strategic outcome, if that's what they believe in.
Does the Labour Party have any reservations about this?
Not that they've said. You know, Shannon Halbert, the Labour Party candidate, welcomed the Greens to the race. I mean, a very gracious message, pointing out that it meant that there was more voices standing for what the government stood for and amplifying that message, outnumbering the opposition.
And so when will the Greens candidate be confirmed?
Sometime in the next couple of weeks. I don't have the exact date, sorry.
Okay. And now on to the Productivity Commission draft report. So the Productivity Commission has estimated that the price of carbon may need to increase by 12 times to $250 a tonne in order to reach the government's goal of net zero emissions by 2050. You said on Morning Report last week that one option being looked at is the prohibitive costs of electric vehicles and the proposal to alleviate this by putting a levy on fossil fuel-powered vehicles and subsidising electric vehicles. So firstly, how might this work?
Well, can I just start by talking about the price on carbon? You talked about it going up to $250. That's at the very top end, only if we fail to take any action. And this is one of the big points that the Productivity Commission said, which is that if we start early and we're consistent in our policy, then actually the price of carbon doesn't actually need to increase by nearly that much, right? So they talked about a sort of a low-end scenario of $75 by the year 2050, and only $30 by the year 2030, remembering that it's $22 now. So, you know, essentially what they're saying is the later you leave it and the less you do in the interim, the higher the price will have to be. And when it comes to things like electric vehicles, well, there's a whole range of options there. The only one that the government's committed to at the moment is the idea of electrifying the government fleet. And what that will do is to help to stimulate the second-hand market, which is, of course, where the vast majority of us get our vehicles. But there are a lot of options, and the Productivity Commission gave us, several different options to look at, which I imagine we'll do over the course of the next few months.
On the government fleet, do you know what the model of car will be? Because I know previously it's a fancy 7 Series BMW.
Well, there you're talking about the Crown cars. That's a tiny number of vehicles, right? We're actually talking about the tens of thousands of cars that are driven by the equivalent of company car fleets in the different government agencies. This is going to take us a while to work through, but we're sort of working out, what would need to change about government procurement in order to try and electrify the government fleet. Generally, fleet vehicles stay in operation, whether they're public sector or private sector, for about 3 to 5 years, and then they end up in the second-hand market. And, of course, it's at that point that the vast majority of New Zealanders, that's where we get our cars, is second-hand. The people who buy new vehicles are generally companies and public sector car fleet buyers. So what we're looking at is a way to try and stimulate the second-hand market.
And so there's the common sentiment that electric vehicles are pointless if the electricity they run on isn't green and renewable. So where are we with that? How much of New Zealand's energy is currently renewable?
Well, at the moment, 85% of our electricity comes from renewable sources, which is great. That puts us ahead of just about every country in the world except for Iceland and Norway. And so that's good. If we do electrify the fleet, of course, that'll lead to an increase in demand for electricity. So then we'll have to be building additional generation capacity. And you can do that in a number of different ways. The most exciting emerging technology is, of course, rooftop solar plus battery. And you're starting to see in a number of places, particularly in Auckland, actually, with Vector, starting to install rooftop solar and battery and then connecting that to people's cars. You might charge your home battery during the day using your solar. You come home at night, you plug your car in, and it charges from the battery overnight, and then it's ready to go in the morning. So over time, that's the kind of thing that we're looking at.
Great. Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, James.
Thanks for having me back.
Have a good day.
See you next week.
See ya.
See ya.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire. The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
May the 4th is International Sauvignon Blanc Day, and to celebrate, 95 BFM and Villa Maria Estate are teaming up for great times and great wines at the Lula Inn.
Featuring a performance from legendary vocalist Sandy Mill and BFM DJs Tina Turntables and Automatic.
Plus, it's absolutely free.
If you want to win tickets to our exclusive catered BFM pre-party, then just stay tuned to Breakfast, Morning Glory and Drive all this week.
But you've got to have a B-card. Get yours at 95bfm.com/signup.
Don't assume you're immune. Even if you've had all of your childhood vaccinations, if you're under 19 years old, you may not be completely protected anymore. Simply check if you're up to date by visiting your student health centre or GP and put your mind at ease. And if you're not covered, get immunised now. For more info, visit getimmunised.org.nz or call 0800 IMMUNE. That's 0800 466 863.
This is a bit awkward, eh?
Yeah, blind dates.
did you see the new Transformers movie?
Nah.
Some weather we're having.
Yeah, surf on the West Coast is an absolute zero.
Oh my god, do you surf? That is so sexy.
Well, I like to say informed. Yesterday, zero. Day before, one. But last Tuesday, it was a four. Major swells. Epic.
Don't stop. I love this.
Shocker. The 95 BFM Surf Report. All the surf, all the time. Brought to you by Pro Gear Professional Photographics.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
Yes, indeed. I have in studio with me today the manager of the New Zealand Institute for Pacific Research, Dr. Evelyn Masters. Sri Krishnamurti from the Pacific Media Centre, and also Professor David Robbie, Director of the PMC. How are we?
Yeah, good. Thanks for having us.
So, Evelyn, we'll start off with you. The sure. Pacific Research Institute, based here at the University of Auckland, started up in 2016, and you have just recently taken over as Research Operations Manager of the Institute, which is a collaboration between the University of Auckland, AUT, and Otago University, with some other institutions. What do you see as the main opportunities in this new role?
I think there's a lot of opportunities. We've been running since 2016, and so we're really going through a bit of a growth spurt and stretching out our research into all areas across the Pacific. So at the moment, we've got quite a few interesting research projects that are coming out with some interesting findings, and these range from the topics of using church-based responses to gender-based violence. We've got one on imagining a Polynesia without electricity grids. We've got another one about the vanilla industry in the Pacific. And so they're all really innovative, exciting projects. But I think one of the most exciting bits for me as a communications person and a project manager is that we're actually working really hard to strengthen the Pacific research community and our relationships with other universities, but also working really hard to increase the capacity and capability of emerging Pacific scholars. So that's a really important part of my work, is making sure that the capacity and the capability of Pacific research is growing and growing, and that we're the ones doing the research and doing the findings.
Yeah, cool. Can you tell me a bit about the vanilla industry? That sounds interesting.
Yeah, well, this is one that's actually based at the University of Auckland with Associate Professor Christina Stringer. And so they're actually trying to look at the vanilla industry and how that can sink into global supply chains. So growing that as a viable industry and leading hopefully to economic growth and sustainable livelihoods. And that research is just about to go forward into a field research stage, and they're heading off to the Cook Islands, Niue and Samoa really soon. So we should get some results from that research around August.
Yeah, cool. BFM will have some interview about that when the results are published.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, Sri, you're both a postgraduate digital media student at AUT and a very experienced journalist originally from Fiji. So what's your role?
My role is to support Evelyn, first of all, and secondly to get into mainstream the projects that we have. And the mainstream media is essential to how we function.
So how do you go about getting it into the mainstream?
I know the media list, I know the context, and I've just got to get them interested in what is happening.
Right.
And make them aware of what is happening.
Do you feel that you have to sell it to them at all?
At this stage, I don't think so. It's very, very new to me.
If I could speak to that a little bit, I think with research and the way that NZIPR is a little bit different, is that we are wanting to communicate our results, and we are wanting to transform academic research into an audience-wide, easy-to-digest format, okay? So we've got a website, we've got blogs happening, we're doing seminars, which can hopefully reach out not only to the general public, but also to make sure that we're feeding back the results to the Pacific communities who live in the Pacific. Mm. The point is to work towards sustainable development goals in the Pacific. And I think the more information we can provide the general public, then it raises awareness, and then hopefully the research has more impact.
Great. And now, David, just turning to the wider Pacific news issues now, there have been some big developments in this past week over media freedom. The Reporters Without Borders have released their annual RSF World Press Freedom Index, and there have been some gains and some losses for Pacific countries. What are they?
Well, yes, Reporters for Without Borders is one of the main index that's produced every year, and so Pacific countries look with bated breath how they're going to sort of fare in the reports. And with the latest report, both Tonga and Papua New Guinea have lost places, dropped down, and so also has Samoa. And I think particularly with Tonga, it's a very interesting case, because we've got World Press Freedom Day on this Thursday, May 3rd, celebrated all over the world. Doesn't usually make a lot of headlines in New Zealand, but certainly around the world and around the Pacific, it's taken very, very seriously. And the Pacific Islands News Association, which is the main regional media body based in Fiji, is holding its every 2 years convention in Tonga. So there's going to be a lot of interest in what happens there. But I guess the real question is about Fiji. Now, surprisingly, Fiji has jumped 10 places, gone you know, considerably higher than it was, which has basically taken it up to really about 57th position. So it's still low down, but it was quite a big jump. But the real test, I think, for Fiji will be later this year with the second general election after the coup years. So there's going to be a real watching brief on Fiji, because although there have been some improvements, particularly since the 2014 election, still there's a chilling factor for the news media in Fiji, and there's still the draconian decree that was imposed in 2009 by the then coup government, the Media Development Media Industry Development Decree, which has very draconian powers and basically gives a real scare factor to a lot of journalists in Fiji. And now we've got to the stage now where there's a whole generation of journalists that have never known what it's been like to be in a country with a real generally free media.
How exactly is press freedom measured?
Well, there's a whole complex, it's an algorithm system that's worked out by RSF, but they basically have a whole number of measures based around freedom issues, for example, if countries that have deaths of journalists, for example, assassinations, disappearances and so on, obviously, drop very low down on the scale of things, such as North Korea, for example, right at the bottom. And China is very bad. China is regarded as a big threat in the Asia-Pacific region at the moment. So that's one factor, but there are other factors as well, such as choice of information, plurality of the media. And this is where New Zealand didn't do very well in the last RSF index and dropped, because New Zealand's been quite good over the last few years. It's been in the top 10 countries in the world, along with countries in Scandinavia, but it dropped out of the last the top 10 in the last review. And that was because it appeared to be that there was going to be a threat with the combining of Fairfax and NZME. But the Commerce Commission, of course, scuppered that. And so New Zealand has actually come back up into the top 10 now. Papua New Guinea is a big worry as well. It's during the elections last year, there was violence against journalists. PNG is probably the most concerning country in the region at the moment.
And even the Pacific Media Centre itself has been in the news lately over media freedom. So Facebook has been accused of censoring a photograph by a leading photojournalist, and Pacific Media have been up in arms about this. What's the backstory?
Yes, well, Ben Behane, he's probably one of the top photojournalists in the whole region. Originally Australian, but he's taken out Vanuatu citizenship. He's been based in Vanuatu for many years now. And he had a photograph that it was illustrating a two-page spread article that he wrote about, saying that China's not really so much the threat in the Pacific, but Indonesia is the major threat, particularly over West Papua and the issue of West Papua and so on. And the photograph was of West Papuans in the highlands, they're in customary dress, or we rather say customary undress, because they had numbers, that is the penis sheaths and so on. But this photograph has been published very widely and so on. And so Facebook basically banned it on the basis of community standards, but it's generally widely believed that's not actually the real reason. It's the reason about Indonesian interference and trying to shut down debate about West Papua and West Papuan stories and images and so on. The Vanuatu Daily Post, which published the article in the first place, and then we followed, we work very closely with the Post, they doctored the image and said, had a little legend on it saying, well, they covered up the questionable part of the photograph and said, happy now, Facebook, sort of thing. But it's still, they were taken down, and they're taken off the Pacific Media Centre and others. But eventually Radio New Zealand's Media Watch program on Sunday, yesterday, featured this as a major issue, and they talked about other important current affairs photographs that have been censored in the past by Facebook. Well, notably, they remember the Napalm girl in Vietnam, which is extraordinary photos, one that's credited with contributing to the end of the Vietnam War and things like that. And that was actually censored for some time by Facebook. So it's a bit of a worrying issue, and it's quite interesting that we're right in the middle of this saga.
Yeah, that it brings about questions as to governments, and in this case Indonesia's influence with Facebook. It's pretty crazy.
Well, it's very disturbing that that governments behind the scenes can have this this sort of influence in Facebook. And of course, there's an ongoing debate about Facebook and credibility. And the ironies are that our approach is you just shed light on this and so publicise it, and so hopefully that changes are made around the policies.
Mm. Well, righty. Well, thank you all for being here. Very much appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Ruben.
And yeah, hope you
thank
have
you.
A good day and good luck with the projects.
Thanks.
Awesome.
That was the Southern Cross.
Sandra Gray is the president of the Tertiary Education Union. She recently spoke at a forum at Mass University and said that the privatisation of universities impedes the ability of academics to discuss the actions of powerful institutions. An article published on the union's website on Election Day last year discussed how the previous national government posed significant threats to academic freedom. Mary Margaret Slack started by asking Sandra what role the Tertiary Education Union play in ensuring New Zealand universities do indeed have academic freedom.
In Australia, there's been this growing level of unease amongst consumers and some politicians for a long time. And quite fascinatingly, in the end, the Turnbull government initially said, no, we aren't going to do a royal commission. But in the end, it was the chairman of the four largest banks that said, no, we want a royal commission because we need to restore confidence and trust of the public in what we do. So that's the level of unease that had been reached. And there was an interesting moment of self-awareness on the part of the banks that they needed a royal commission to, get this all out on the table and put things right and move on.
And so the main accusation is that AMP charged thousands of customers fees for advice that was never given. How much damage will this have caused?
Well, judging by some of the press I've seen in Australia since, quite a lot, the most cutting comment from one business commentator is, what's the point of AMP? This is a financial services company that's considerably lost its way since it was once a great mutually owned insurance company, and then crikey, way back in about the late 90s it demutualized, it turned itself into a shareholder owned company, it's substantially lost its way. So that's kind of the extreme end of the response, but this isn't good for AMP.
Will they still have a future?
In any corporate situation like this, it's usually possible to build back. I mean, this is not, there have been more egregious things that happened with companies. So, for example, Volkswagen over a decade produced 11 million cars with software, diesel-powered cars with software to cheat on emissions tests, and it's costing them the thick end of about $20 billion in fines, buying back cars. It goes on and on and on. But Volkswagen has just set a record sales, it hasn't entirely recovered its reputation in some quarters. But it's possible for companies to come back from worse disasters than this. But they need to be extremely active about setting a new course, a new culture for the company, and convince their customers very quickly that they're serious about that.
The resignation of the now former CEO on Friday, and he said that he wanted to restore trust of customers with AMP, and so it was time for him to step down. Do you think that is the reason?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Somebody needs to carry the can for this sort of thing. It's perfectly appropriate for the CEO to go.
Okay, so as opposed to him weaseling out of accountability, that is actually him taking culpability for what's happened?
Yeah. In situations like this, the company helps ease the pain of departure in various ways, financial and otherwise.
Right. And so AMP only started giving evidence to the Royal Commission last Monday, and the resignation had happened by Friday last week. Do you think that we can expect more to come out from here?
The way the Royal Commission is structured is there's sort of three big phases of hearings, and this was the second phase. And the third phase next month is about lending to the agricultural sector. Well, we know from problems that farmers have had with banks here with some products like interest rate swaps and various ways to try and hedge their interest rate risk, which has resulted in some court cases by farmers against the banks and some progress against the banks on that. And that there's probably quite a lot to come out in that area too. Now, it won't be so high profile because as big as the agricultural sector is in Australia, it's not the same as the whole mass consumer market for retail financial services. But something might come out of that. But I'm still would be slightly surprised, I think, if there were even one or two more resignations as this unfolds.
The example that I've seen used in a lot of places is one elderly widowed pensioner tried to save hundreds annually on her superannuation, and the advice that she was given was to put her $32,000 of savings into an investment scheme that charged her over $1,000 a year, and it would have taken 14 years for her to break even. Yeah. Is it mostly Australians who have been hurt by AMP's false financial advice, or has it happened in New Zealand too?
AMP in New Zealand has made it very clear that they run a different kind of business model in terms of the services they're offering, and it's under different regulation, and it's whilst part of the AMP group is run separately. So it's gone to great lengths to say that something like that wouldn't happen here, which has been their basic response. Overall, we've found that the response actually all the way through from the Reserve Bank and the government, from industry associations here, this view that, oh, it's different here in New Zealand because our financial services and banking industry works under different regulation, different type of regulation, its independence, a different culture and all the rest. But the fact is that the Insurance and Financial Services Ombudsman's Office had something like 314 complaints last year, which it investigated. But it found that none of them were systemic, they were, one-off issues. But then you sort of flick that round the other way and say, well, we don't know yet whether it was systemic within AMP in Australia that people like that elderly person were taken advantage of. So I think there's a fine line between a culture which pops up in various places of an organization and does a fair amount of damage along the way. And yet people say, well, that's not systemic. That's just some bad people who've gone off the rails. So I think we're just being a little bit too complacent here in New Zealand that we don't have any of these problems. It just intuitively doesn't feel quite right to me that that's the case. I think we're a long way short of getting some kind of government inquiry or Royal Commission. But there is a steady flow of complaints to ombudsmen or to regulators about things that go wrong here. So I just think the financial services sector is just being a little bit too complacent to say, oh, it's completely different here, culturally, regulatory and everything else. And it'll be very interesting to see once the Royal Commission process has worked its way through and big regulatory changes are expected in Australia, as to whether that will then have some knock-on effect on how we do regulation of the banking and financial services sector here in New Zealand.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Apologies for that mix-up, everyone. We introduced that story as an interview with the Tertiary Education Union. However, that was business journalist Rod Oram discussing AMP's hearings in Australia, and we can give you the background now. So AMP is a life insurance and retirement savings provider with over 4 million customers across Australia and New Zealand. In our country, AMP is one of the biggest financial advice networks, with 240,000 KiwiSaver customers and a 12% share in the KiwiSaver market. 2 weeks ago, AMP began hearings with the Royal Commission in Australia after the Commission became aware that AMP had lied to Australia's corporate watchdog body for a decade. So much evidence came out in the first few days of hearings that AMP CEO stood down. The core focus of the hearings is that the company charged at least 15,000 customers for financial advice that was never delivered. As Rod and I discussed, one elderly widowed pensioner who was trying to save hundreds annually on her superannuation was told to put her savings into an investment scheme that charged her over $1,000 a year, and it would have taken her 14 years to break even. So stay tuned next week to hear the academic freedom story that we teased just before.
The Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wives. Wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
That's right, you're listening to The Wire. The time is 44 minutes past 12. We'll be right back on the interview about homelessness in New Zealand right after probably the best song in the entire world. No. It's not playing. We'll just go into the homelessness. So, according to various studies and reports, New Zealand has the worst homelessness rate in the OECD, basically meaning that we are the worst out of the rich countries. This means that 1 in 100 people roundabouts in this country are severely deprived of adequate housing. I speak to Auckland University academic Shiloh Groot about why homelessness is so bad in New Zealand and what can and should be done about it. According to various reports, New Zealand has the worst rate of homelessness in the OECD, and we've seen a dramatic increase in homelessness over the past two decades. What economic and social policies have led to this, do you think?
Well, I think the previous government, I think the social austerity most certainly helped to exacerbate issues of inequities in New Zealand. So these increasing rises within those last two decades definitely occurred within that time frame, right? So there was a lot of the welfare sanctions, a lot of the housing, sort of selling up state housing, things like this, an inability to look at state care abuses, all sorts of really exasperated prisons as well, increasing prison populations and then decreasing sort of community infrastructures meant that people exiting different institutions had no support and nowhere to go. I think there was a lack of humanity in previous approaches to social issues, and that's why we see these massive increases.
So would you say this is a symptom of what some people might call neoliberalism?
Definitely. Sure. I mean, this is, we tend to see ourselves as a small and isolated nation, but homelessness is a social issue that you can see in many different countries, right? I'd be surprised to know if there is a country without some issue of homelessness. And neoliberalism is directly impacting this. It's about creating those inequities so that the affluent few can rise above the vast majority who are not doing as well. So yeah, I do think neoliberalism plays a huge part in this.
What exactly needs to be done or can be done to mitigate it?
Well, I think we have the political will now. We're at a historic point in New Zealand history. This is the first time as a country that we have a central government that's willing to recognise that homelessness is an issue in our country and put some resourcing behind that. So I think that's a really great first step in terms of addressing homelessness and responding in a way that's humane. So that's a positive first step. I think we are trying to look at some of those policies that exacerbate the likelihood that people are going to, that some groups are going to be more represented in homelessness. We need to do much, much more, but we're making those steps, particularly when we think about the inquiry into state care abuses, if we're looking at some of the massive overhaul that's been proposed of our welfare system. These are positive steps in the right direction. But really, I think it's about communities coming together as well, and communities at all levels, not just communities in the sense of these isolated communities that have already had to be shouldering the burden of these really harmful policies, but looking at New Zealand as a community and coming together.
A lot of the other countries in the OECD have huge levels of inequality. They went through periods of mass privatization, selling off of public housing stock. So New Zealand's not alone in that, but why is it just so bad in New Zealand?
Because we've ignored it for so long. I think part of the problem is, again, because we're a small isolated nation, we tend to think that we kind of talk about it as a physical isolation, but in a way we always act as if we're isolated in all sense of the word. But yeah, sure, a lot of these countries, they were doing this long before us in terms of privatisation, selling of public housing, all that. They were doing it long before us. And oddly enough, when we look to places like the US and the UK, we pick up on those policies, even though they've failed hugely and dismally in different countries, and then we adopt them ourselves. And we're kind of looking for those quick fix solutions too often to suit the sort of short-term days that governments will have. And so we end up with these really quick fix solutions that aren't going to really work.
What programs can you see as working to help these people, like Housing First, for example?
Housing First is one program. Sure, that's one particular program that's showing promise overseas, depending how it's applied. But it's, and I think there's a lot of people that have already been doing it here in New Zealand, certainly even before, you know, the label Housing First was attached to it, and it's shown some promise, definitely, but it's just one approach. I think it would be short-sighted to focus on just Housing First as a primary response. There should be multiple responses. There's lots of populations that hasn't worked with Indigenous people. Sometimes it doesn't work for families. It does work for chronic people experiencing chronic homelessness in some spots. It's one part of the picture. If we keep focusing on housing as the resolution for homelessness and forget that there's putting people in a house isn't necessarily going to remove all the problems that caused homelessness in the first place. So you need that sort of structural interventions as well as those really practical applied things like Housing First.
So you think with the change of government to now a Labor-led government, they will make some substantial progress in this area?
It's hard to say substantial, isn't it? But it certainly is the will. They've been a long time. Labor's certainly been for a long time holding up the banner that, you know, we need to do something about homelessness, we need to respond to homelessness. So certainly there's always been that will with Labor and the Greens and Māori Party before they were dismantled. So there's certainly been the will to address homelessness there. And so it's positive in a sense to see them now in government, in central government. So you would assume definitely that they would do something. They're showing promise in terms of supporting programs like Housing First, engaging with diverse service providers, community organisations, homeless people themselves, to kind of look at, you know, how can we respond appropriately, effectively and humanely.
Can you tell me about some of your research in this field?
So I predominantly looked at homelessness, Māori homelessness, so experiences of homelessness for Māori. So what makes homelessness unique? Well, what it looks like for us as Māori. So, of course, we've experienced homelessness not just at those personal individual levels, but at the whānau, at the hapū, at the iwi, at a national level. So looking at the way in which you can't just talk about homelessness as individual, around individual narratives of trauma, but have to understand that it's been a part of colonisation.
Looking within and beyond the community, lessons learned by researching, theorising and acting to address urban poverty and health. Can you tell me a bit about that one?
So that was the F100 project. So that was looking more at urban poverty for families. Did a collaborative project with the Auckland City Mission looking at 100 families that they worked with closely who were accessing their food bank multiple times in a year. And so they wanted to understand what was impeding those families from not being able to feed themselves and their families and their kids. And so we engaged with them about over a year, 2 years, alongside the social workers who have a long history of working with them compassionately and just looking at the ways in which their lives were being challenged by the social austerity measures at the time.
And how does urban versus rural poverty differ?
I think there tends to be a huge focus on urban poverty, and that is to the detriment of the rural communities. And it's going to differ because there's a higher concentration of services, there's a higher concentration of funding. Because all that attention is on, you know, large urban centres like Auckland, it tends to take away a lot of the resources and much-needed focus. And I think that is an issue.
How do we measure homelessness in this country?
Well, I'm not a statistician, I'm a qualitative researcher, but sure, because we're such a small population, And we look to places like the US, the UK, and in Australia with these massive populations and where the issues just seem so much bigger on a different scale as well. It's hard to believe that a country like New Zealand could possibly be experiencing worse or similar levels of inequities. I mean, we ignore these when we're talking about child homicide, child abuse, when we talk about suicide statistics. We know New Zealand is comparing pretty badly to a lot of other OECD countries, but we measure it in terms of income distributions, we measure it in terms of exploitation, we measure it in terms of job security, employment, unemployment, all those.
And what exactly is the definition of homelessness?
Statistics New Zealand developed a definition of homelessness that was borrowed from a European typology. We had previously used the Australian conceptual categories, but these ones is about four categories that are meant to capture the spectrum of experiences around housing instability. So it can be living from any sort of situation as living under a bridge, overcrowding, to living in refuges. It's meant to capture that, not just homelessness as that bricks and mortar sort of, or absence of a bricks and mortar shelter, but it's also meant to carry those legal, those social, so to look at the sort of not just bricks and mortar, like I said, but also a lack of safety and dignity.
And how does that differ from poverty?
Well, it's not. Homelessness is the sharp edge of poverty. We kind of talk about them as if they're separate, but homelessness is just the sharp edge of poverty. It's kind of like homeless people are almost like the canary in the mine. You know, when the miners used to go down into the mines and human nose can't detect the smell of gas, so they take a canary. So if a canary dies first while they're down in the mine, they know there's a leak and they need to get out. Homelessness is the canary in the mine. It's a symptom of something much, much bigger.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
From Wes Anderson, director of the Grand Budapest Hotel, comes Isle of Dogs.
That boy flew here all alone to find his dog.
It's an adventure unlike anything you've seen before.
You're looking for your lost dog Spots. Does anybody know him?
No. Wherever he is, we'll find him.
With an all-star voice cast including Jeff Goldblum, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton and Scarlett Johansson, you'd be barking mad to miss it. Isle of Dogs in cinemas Thursday. Rated PG, contains violence and coarse language.
It's music. We played it first. BFM, the original originator. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95BFM.com.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
That was The Wire.
Yep, that's The Wire for today. We just had a text in. Poverty and homelessness are an outcome of an overly controlled society. A free society is a prosperous society. Cheers, Peter. More freedom, less government. Yep, those are the texts we like to hear. Alrighty, stay tuned for next week to hear the academic freedom story that we teased just before. And thanks producers Lucy and Mary Margaret, and thanks for everyone who came on the show today. David Chirlionis, Jam Shaw, Evelyn Masters, Sri Krishnamurti, David Robbie, Rod Oram and Shyla Groot. Thank you for listening. That's your Monday Wire. We'll catch you next week.